Blaze Radio Network.
And now, the Rabbi Daniel Appin Show.
The more the world changes, the more we find comfort in the things that never change. This is Rabbi Daniel Appin, on demand, on the Blaze Radio Network.
Greetings to all you happy warriors, and welcome to the Rabbi Daniel Appin Show, where I, your rabbi, remain, as always, dedicated to revealing how the world really works. Thanks for being part of the show, and thank you for all you do in promoting the show and getting the word around. And thank you also to all you happy warriors who placed early orders for our new book, the book that Susan Lappin and I have been working on for many years, called The Holistic You, Integrating Your Family, Your Friendships, Your Finance, Your Faith, and Your Fitness. And that book, The Holistic You, is now shipping. Many of you have already received it. And I thank you very much indeed. It had a very good, strong launch on account of what it was that you all did. So very much appreciated, and onwards and upwards with that. If you haven't already taken a look at the book, shoot over either to our website or to Amazon's website or to Barnes & Noble's website or wherever you get your books, and go ahead and get your copy of The Holistic You. The topic today, the topic or the title, same thing, is I must make money, but just don't know what to do. And this was the result of a chance encounter I had recently with a fan of the show. And from our conversation, I realized that this was a topic that did want talking about. But in addition to that, I am recording this show shortly before the very serious and important day in the Jewish religious calendar, the Day of Atonement, which we call in Hebrew Yom Kippur. And what's interesting about that, of course, is that that word Kippur is the same word that is the derivation of the, or the etymological root of the English word cover, like a cover-up. And the idea is Day of Atonement. It's, you can't make things go away, but you can cover them up, and you can function in that way very reasonably, in the same way that if you know, if there happens to be a mess, perhaps a dog deposited some fecal matter on the floor, it's disturbing and you want to get rid of it and get the place cleaned up as quickly as possible. But if you have no option, you put a box over it or something so it's out of sight and possibly the smell is somewhat confined. Covering something up is an entirely doable thing. Pretending that something never happened is just unrealistic. And a large part of a Day of Atonement is understanding how and training ourselves to be able to function, realizing our imperfections, filled with regrets for things that we have done in the past, and fill us with a sense of self dislike. And it makes it very difficult to continue with life and continue doing the things that you want to do. And so we have an annual program, lasts for 25 hours. And it's a very focused program. That's why we don't eat. We don't not eat in order to torment ourselves or punish ourselves. We don't eat in order not to distract ourselves and to focus a little bit more during those hours on the spiritual than on the physical. And It was exactly 50 years ago that the Yom Kippur War launched in Israel. As you know, the Jewish calendar slides backwards and forwards by about a month with respect to the solar calendar. And so this year, 2023, Yom Kippur falls on September the 25th. But back in 1973, Yom Kippur fell on October the 6th. And in Israel, on Yom Kippur, it's very quiet. A large part of the population is in synagogue for the whole day. And so, for instance, it's a day where many streets are closed. People walk down busy expressways just because there's no traffic. It's an eerie day. It's a most extraordinary thing. Obviously, shops and offices and businesses are shut. Everything is shut. And you'd have thought that the beaches would be full, but they're not. And even though a large part of Israel's population is not religious, it's not like in America. In America, not religious pretty much means hostile to faith and to tradition. Not religious in America largely tends towards the left. In Israel, that's not necessarily the case. And even people who are not actively religious nonetheless retain a fairly close connection to the faith. And so the synagogues are packed. I mean, almost everybody is in synagogue in Israel on Yom Kippur, which, as I say, will be February 25. September 25 this year. But in the year 1973, it was October the 6th. And it was at 2 p.m., 2 o'clock in the afternoon, just before 2 o'clock, a high-ranking officer in the Egyptian Air Force by the name of Hosni Mubarak. As you well know, he became one of the longest-serving Egyptian presidents, serving, I think, from 1980 or 81 to 2011. And he was upset then by, you may remember, the wonderful Arab Spring stimulated by President Barack Obama. So at any rate, Hosni Mubarak in his jet shot up an Israeli communications base just over the Suez Canal. And he went back to his base, Hosni Mubarak, after the successful destruction of the Israeli communication base. And 5 minutes later, at 2 p.m., the Arab armies of Egypt and Syria launched their attack. Egypt crossing the Suez Canal and Syria heading in from the northeast. And by the time the ceasefire had been established, which was about October 23rd or 24th approximately, nearly 3,000 Israeli soldiers had been killed. Now, that may not sound like a lot to you, but let me put that into the context. That would be the same as if in America 300,000 soldiers were killed. Am I right? Yes. 300,000. That's right. Now, remember that the deaths on 9/11 were about 3,000. So 100 times more than that. And it gives you an idea of what America would be like if 300,000 soldiers were lost in 2 weeks of fighting. Well, that's what Israel had happen in October 1973. The hero of the 1967, the Six-Day War, which was, you know, only 6 years earlier in Israel, was a one-eyed general called Moshe Dayan, a courageous guy, almost to the point of reckless, with some terrible flaws and weaknesses as well. And he had lost an eye fighting in France during World War II for the British. And he was the visible icon of the Israeli Defense Forces in 1967. And he was turned into a national hero by the Six-Day War. He made a number of terrible mistakes. One of them was handing over, although Israel had conquered all of Jerusalem, in this mistaken belief that if you act magnanimously towards all your enemies, they will respond graciously and gratefully. And so he handed over the Temple Mount in Jerusalem to Arab control. And since then, that little piece of Jerusalem has served as a base for insurrection and rioting and killing and stone throwing and all kinds of terrible things. But at any rate, Moshe Dayan, on the 6th of October, was completely shocked and surprised. There was a massive intelligence failure, in spite of the fact that Israel had some very highly placed spies in Egypt who had warned a day and a half earlier that war was imminent, and the report hadn't made its way up the chain. There were really, really bad mistakes made. And so when the Arab armies, hundreds of thousands of soldiers, began pouring over two borders, giving Israel a two-front war, everyone was shocked. And 2 days later, by which time Egypt had made dramatic progress into the Sinai Desert, which had been owned by Israel since the Six-Day War and served as a very valuable barrier or buffer, because Israel's core military doctrine is for any fighting to be moved onto the enemy's territory as quickly as possible. And so instead of having Egypt's armies mass in the Sinai Desert and crossing over and being in Tel Aviv within a few hours, Egypt armies had to be on the other side of the Suez Canal, and they never made it into the civilian populated part of Israel. But within 2 days they'd made astonishing progress, because Israel was caught napping, or to be more precise, was caught praying in synagogue. And so it took a long time to get people back to their bases and to mobilize. And even so, in spite of the fact that Syria and Egypt had been mobilizing for months with huge numbers of men on both borders, Israel had just assumed that that was just another training. And they also made very terrifying progress in from Syria. 2 days later, Dayan tried to call a press conference to declare the end of Israel and to start international efforts to protect the civilian population, because both Arab armies had made absolutely clear that their goal was the annihilation, not just the political conquering, but the annihilation of all Israelis, or as they colorfully put it, to throw all Israelis into the Mediterranean. And Golda Meir, who was Prime Minister of Israel at the time, had to take action to prohibit Dayan from holding his press conference to declare the end of Israel. I mean, that's literally what he wanted to do. And turns out he had a whole breakdown. And for a number of years after the Yom Kippur War in 73, Dayan basically hid out from public. It was a disaster. He was humiliated. He was very much responsible for much that happened, and it wasn't good. And so the other thing that's interesting is that while Israel was being defeated, and this is worth knowing, this is worth understanding in terms of geopolitics and world drama, it's worth understanding. So let me just make this clear. While Israel looked as if it was going to be destroyed, And this is the first 2.5 days, October 6th, October 7th, October 8th, and into the 9th. It looked as if it was all over. The Syrians were advancing from the north, the Egyptians from the south, and Egypt was going to be brought to an end. And as I say, even Moshe Dayan was convinced it was all over. There was no point in fighting. And during that time, the Soviet Union, the then Soviet Union, ignored all attempts made by Henry Kissinger and President Richard Nixon to bring peace, to stop the fighting in the Middle East. Soviet Union had no interest. United Nations Secretary General Kurt Waldheim could barely be bothered to come to the phone. He was absolutely not interested. Essentially, the UN and the Soviet Union were quite okay with the obliteration of Israel off the map. Then, after a few days, the tide began to turn, and Israel began to get its military up and running and going, and they began pushing back. And within quite a little time, Israel had crossed back over the Suez Canal, had encircled and destroyed Egypt's Third Army, and were on the road to Damascus. And now, all of a sudden, the Soviet Union was calling dramatic, we've got to have peace, there's got to be a ceasefire. The United Nations, everybody was into the ceasefire. So I have to tell you, this is something that Israelis in general and Jews pretty much remember very clearly, that in terms of the United Nations and the Soviet Union and even Great Britain, by the way, England had declared a boycott on supplying spare parts to Israel during this period. Meanwhile, Henry Kissinger and, well, it was, I shouldn't say Kissinger, it was really Richard Nixon, started sending huge military transports, taking equipment to replace what was being destroyed in Israel very, very rapidly. And the British, although Israel had purchased large numbers of British Centurion tanks, the British refused to supply any spare parts during this time. So again, there was something. The Israel has somewhat mixed feelings about Britain, as does South Africa, by the way, because of the treatment of Britain during the way Britain treated South Africa during the Boer War, as do parts of Ireland. You know, definitely mixed feelings. Meanwhile, I should tell you that the biggest tank battle in the history of the world since Germans and Russians fought at Kursk in World War II on Germany's Eastern Front, that was slightly bigger. But other than that, the biggest tank engagement, the biggest tank battle was fought in the Sinai, in the Western Sinai Desert near the Suez Canal from October 12th through the 14th in 1973. And there were 1,000 tanks massed there fighting. And by the time that battle ended, Israel had destroyed 250 Egyptian tanks. That was just actually in the first few hours. Israel had destroyed 250 Egyptian tanks. And then soon after that, they routed the Egyptian army and headed over the Suez Canal. They were in gunning distance of Cairo, and on the North Front, they were on the road to Damascus when the Soviet Union said, we're going to move troops to protect Damascus. They said to America, if you don't stop the Israelis advancing on Damascus, which is exactly what the American government did, naturally. So that's what happens there. The American resupply process was called Operation Nickel Gross. I have no idea why. But 6 days after the war started, October 12th, President Nixon began an emergency airlift. and cargo planes took spare parts, tanks, bombs, helicopters, and they were flying backwards round the clock to Israel. They flew 566 flights of massive American Air Force cargo aircraft, and in a matter of about a week or a week and a half, they delivered 22,000 tons of emergency military equipment during the middle of October 1973. So that's a little bit of that story. And I tell it to you because, as I say, this Yom Kippur, the 25th of September, is the 50th anniversary of the war that really changed things, because there were 6 years of exhilaration in Israel after the Six-Day War. It totally and completely changed everything. I mean, people really believed that a miracle had taken place, as indeed I believe too. And the result was incredible, but it was 6 years. And then came the 73 war, and that was like a big dose of cold water right in the face of the Israelis, because they came very, very close to disaster. As I said, the dominant military personality, Moshe Dayan, General Dayan, himself thought that Israel had been defeated, that it was all over. And indeed, as I say, for 2.5 days, it really, really looked that way. However, they rallied and began pushing back, and there were very, very, very painful sacrifices. As I said, there were a lot of casualties. And but then eventually it did turn into a victory for Israel, although President Sadat of Egypt did regard it as sort of removing the stain of shame that had been hanging over Egypt since 1967. So Egypt kind of looked on it as a victory as well. Anyway, that is the story of the Six-Day War 50 years ago. Talking of 50 years, it's 54 years since the United States of America landed a human being on the surface of the moon. That was in summer of 1969. And I just sometimes think to myself, what would we have said? Everybody is astounded, right? Going back to 1969, and I was on a motorcycle trip through Africa. Yes, young and stupid. And I was riding a motorcycle trip through Africa, and I watched the moon landing on an old black and white TV set that was wedged into the fork of a tree in a small African village. And it had wires running down to the battery of a car with a hood up, and the car was running to keep the battery charged so that villagers could gather around this little black and white TV set and watch the landing of the moon. And I'm trying to think, you know, back then, it seemed this like amazing miracle. NASA, the American space agency, NASA had landed a man on the moon. What would we have said back then had somebody prophesied and told us that in 54 years' time, the same organization, NASA, that landed a man on the moon would be more preoccupied with the hoax of climate change than they would be with anything having to do with space? That's really what NASA's involved in now. It's nonsense. And all they try to do is each year secure their funding with Congress. It comes up every October. And before that, every year they always make some announcement about promising signs of life in outer space in order to make sure that the government renews their funding for yet another year. There are a lot of organizations that should do the decent thing and involve themselves in assisted suicide. They should get advice from the Canadians on how to do this. The Canadians are very big now on encouraging the ill and the elderly to terminate their lives. Well, NASA has pretty much fulfilled its purpose. It's not doing anything. It's just consuming money and providing sheltered employment for many, many people. It's not doing anything. another organization that should do the decent thing and die is NATO. Again, you know, it's become sheltered employment for huge numbers of people doing absolutely nothing and having absolutely no purpose in the world. But there it is. Still, not the subject of today's show, because the rest of the show is dedicated to the question that I raised just a little bit earlier, the beginning of the show, the title of the show, I Must Make Money, But Just Don't Know What to Do. So what is the advice? Now, it so happens that as these things happen, the Ask the Rabbi, you know what Ask the Rabbi is, right? The Ask the Rabbi is a regular column. It's a page on our website at rabbidaniellappin.com. And it's also, by the way, if I haven't already asked you, make sure you subscribe. We love it when people subscribe to the show. So if you haven't done that, please do. And we also love it when you order the Holistic You, our new book, as I mentioned a little bit earlier in the show. Okay, so on the Ask the Rabbi page, we had a young woman writing and talking about how she traveled to France because she was accepted into an MBA program, a Masters of Business Administration. And she discovered, what a lot of people discover, is that a university degree is not a license to print money. A university degree does not impose an inviolable obligation on anybody to give you a job. And she wrote, speaking about how with considerable challenge, she completed her Master's of Business Administration. And meanwhile, she is having no luck at all in finding a job. And Susan Lappin and I devoted the Ask the Rabbi this week to answering her question, giving her some thoughts of what she should do. And so this is, in general, this is addressed to anybody who's saying, I need to make money and I don't know what to do. It's addressed primarily to people who have, you know, may have got a university degree or maybe not, in which case they're probably better off. And who's trying to figure out where to start, and they can't decide what they should be, right? There are many people who stupidly took valuable years and valuable money getting degrees on gender inequality in medieval French literature, or getting a degree in middle period Byzantine murals. I mean, this people did this. People wasted time and money getting degrees. And then they discover that there's not a lot of jobs available in those areas in which they got the degree. Fine. So what should somebody in that position do? And I did talk to somebody who spoke to me on this very thing, a young man who is trying to figure out what he should do. And so the advice I'm about to give is for them, but the general principles I think are useful to each and every one of you who is careful about your five F's, and your five F's are your fitness, your family, your friendship, your faith, and your finances. And so I need to make money, but I just do not know what to do. Okay, let me tell you what to do. The answer is in four parts. Part one is find a job. Number two is excel at it. Number three is save money. Number four is work on your physical fitness. All right, there it is. All right, I know I'm not going to leave you with just that. I realize that that is like me asking the winner of the 2012 London 100-meter Olympic sprint, Usain Bolt, how I can run faster. And he would answer and say, Lappin, it's very simple. Just move your legs quicker. Yeah, that doesn't really help me. And so to just say, find a job, excel at it, save money, and work on your physical fitness, I realize that doesn't do it. So let's try and be a little bit more helpful if we can. So first of all, okay, finding a job. Now, the key thing here is not to waste time and energy trying to decide what sort of job to look for, because it doesn't matter. That is going to be one of the most useful things you're going to hear today. It does not matter as long as it makes money. Find a job that will pay you the most money. Now, ideally, it shouldn't be a short-term job, you know, like helping to deal with a Christmas rush at a retailer or at a delivery company. Ideally, it would be a job at a company at which you can remain for a period of time, not decades, but a year or two or three, ideally. But you choose on the basis of where you can make the most. So fine, how do you do that? Well, you do not worry about trying to think of yourself as anything. You know, people think of themselves, well, I'm cut out of executive cloth. I should be an executive. I should be it doesn't matter. Just put that out of your mind. Your job is to find a job. How do you do that? Well, you tell people about it. Now, if you are in a position where you can offer to work for free for a month, that is a very useful tool in your toolbox. It's a very useful weapon in your arsenal because it's an almost irresistible offer. But you've got to be careful. It's got to be somewhere that it makes sense. So tell people, in terms of what it is you're going to be doing, you really should think very seriously about starting off in sales. You've got to start off in sales. I'll tell you why. Most of the promotions in the Fortune 500, and this is a really important thing I'm telling you. Most of the promotions, people who end up in the upper levels of the companies started off in sales. Because in sales, you learn so much. You learn about people. You learn about finance. You learn about the products. You learn about the market. You learn about negotiation. It's a fantastic training ground. And so the reality is that if you are willing to start and make money in sales, you could have a job by next Wednesday. You really could. Not a question. And what you do between now and next Wednesday is you go online and you buy a set of audio CDs of sales training programs by the late, great Zig Ziglar, Z-I-G-Z-I-G-L-A-R. Yes, he was a dear friend of mine. And Zig Ziglar was one of the greatest sales training people ever. And the great thing is now that you can buy on eBay, or other places online, you can buy his sets of sales training material on audio CDs for very little. As a matter of fact, the Zig Ziglar company actually, I think, is selling some of the stuff. Some of Zig's great stuff right now. And so, you know, yeah, I know your current computer may not have a CD drive. It doesn't matter. It'll cost you, you know, $19 to buy a CD drive, plug it into the USB slot, and away you go. At any rate, learn sales. This is worth more than an MBA, as the woman from France, in France, is discovering. So, yes, you can literally walk into a job if you are willing to start off in sales. Great place to start. For interviewing, I've got to tell you two things. For interviewing, I want you to be very meticulous about researching. And there's no excuse today for not doing it. You don't have to spend 3 days in a public library. It's very easy to research. You really must know a lot about the company you are interviewing at, and ideally, you should know something about the person who's interviewing you, but that's not always easy to do. But at least you should know the company well, so you don't sound uninterested and indifferent. If you know about the company, you can sound passionate and interested and vital. Number two, I want you to always be aware how important it is to come across, not come across. Now, I don't want you to be inauthentic. I want you to be genuine, cheerful, and happy. Because I know that when I interview people, and it's the same for anybody else, life's too short to have people around you who drain your happiness, who drain your energy. So be energetic, be vital, be vivacious, be stimulating, but above all, be cheerful, happy, and optimistic, because that is one of the big overlooked secrets of job interview success. And so tell friends and relatives that you're looking for work. You'd like to know about any jobs, any places. Get it out. Look around. But above all, talk to people, because that is the surest way of getting an inside track. When somebody who already works for a company goes to the recruiting director or goes to human resources or goes to the sales manager and says, you know, I don't know if you're looking for anybody or not, but I've got a friend, Tom, who is a terrific salesperson. I've got a friend, Jane, who would be really, really good. Would you give him or her an interview? That is an inside track. And energy and time will be far better invested in talking to everybody you know and everybody who you know knows and would be willing to tell you about, so as that you manage to make first-person connections rather than looking in ads, jobs wanted ads. Believe me, you will do better, much better, by connecting with people and being enthusiastic and being happy and cheerful and speaking about wanting a job. As I say, if you can bring yourself, and I know it's hard, not everyone can do this, but if you can bring yourself to start seeing yourself as a sales professional, and I see sales as a wonderful profession, it's a great, great, great place to begin a business career. Now, I should talk about one other aspect of this as well, and that is some of the people listening are saying to themselves, I'm not going to go look for a job. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm looking for a business opportunity. Look, in 99.9% of the cases I encounter, that simply isn't true. Because if you were an entrepreneur, you'd already be doing it. It's as simple as that. Entrepreneurs do not spend 3 weeks looking for a job. Entrepreneurs do not spend 3 months looking for a job. Entrepreneurs do not spend 9 months trying to decide what they want to do. They just go and do something. So let's accept that you're probably not an entrepreneur, right? And that's fine, because the avenue I'm suggesting, even if you suspect in the back of your mind that one day you'd like to be, this is still a good place to begin. And so go ahead and find a job. Tell people and then perform well in the interview. And meanwhile, give yourself a fantastic business education by studying the programs of Zig Ziglar. And he's wonderful to listen to. So get the stuff, get these CDs, and just listen to him. And you will discover that not only are you able to sell, and not only will you become very good at it, but you'll come to see that you actually enjoy it very much indeed. It's really, really important. And I speak as somebody who thought I was going to work as an electrical engineer. And I even did work as an electrical engineer for a certain period of time for a big Dutch electronics company. And I worked for a certain period of time until I discovered the selling side of the business. And I realized that I'm a people person. And meanwhile, I was stuck in a lab with instruments and electronic components and blueprints on the wall. And I was lucky if I saw another person other than on our weekly lab-wide meetings. And then I discovered that the folks on the sales side, the people who were selling the equipment that I was designing, were making more money and having more fun and interacting with people. They were on the business side. And it didn't take me long to shift over there, I can tell you. So, number one, find a job. Number two, excel at it. And it doesn't matter. It may be you're starting at the very bottom somewhere. Let me tell you the story. I taught this in a church in Huntsville, Alabama. I think it was Huntsville. I think so. Woman came up to me afterwards and said, I have a job, but it's a go-nowhere job. It's a dead-end job. I'm a cashier in a grocery store. She says, and I make enough to support me and my kid, but not very much. And I don't, like, what do you mean I should do? I said, it's very simple. Excel. She said, I don't know what that means. I said, treat your employer's customers as if they're your customers and you are in business for yourself. You are a customer service specialist. And right now, you happen to have one client, right? The ABC grocery market. And they're asking you to ring up the purchases of everybody who comes to the line and wants to check out. But look at those people, not as faceless entities who are customers of your boss. Look at them as your customers. And I saw this beautiful smile of comprehension spread across her face. And she said, oh, I get it. And I said, what do you get? She said, well, I'm going to be polite to each one of them. I said, no, even more than that, smile at each one. And while you're ringing them up, talk to them. You know, get to know them. Well, about 10 months later, I'm back at exactly the same church for a follow-up program on increasing revenue, on helping people increase their income. It's what I do. And I had my daughter, one of my daughters was with me on this trip. And I will readily admit that I cannot tell one dress from another, for the most part. But this daughter of mine, who was about 11 years old at the time, sort of pulled on my jacket. She said, Daddy, do you see that lady there? And she pointed at the woman who I'd last seen 10 months earlier, who was the cashier. And she said, Daddy, she's wearing a designer outfit. Well, I'll tell you that when I saw her 10 months ago, she was wearing, you know, what probably was a Kmart special. I mean, just a very unprepossessing outfit. But even I could see that this was a different story. And so I could hardly wait for her to come up to me, which happily she did even before I started the program. And she wanted to give me a big hug. And I said, well, give my daughter the hug instead. We try and avoid male-female physical contact of all kinds that is not between family members. So no offense, but I'll accept the hug through my... So she gives my daughter a big hug, and then she says, my life has changed. I said, tell me about it. She says, from the very day after you were here 10 months ago, I started doing that. She said, and I started noticing my lines were longer than everybody else. Not because I'm slower, but people started wanting to come to my checkout lane. And it didn't take long before my bosses noticed. She said, and I was asked to give training to some of the other new checkers who are starting to work for the company, and they gave me a raise and paid me for that. She says, and then one day in the line is a guy who didn't have much in the way of purchases. I think he had a cup of yogurt or something, and he said to me, may I ask what time you get off? And she said, why? I said, well, I'd like to talk to you, and I don't want to talk to you on your work time. And she said to me, she said, Rabbi, you know, he seemed a nice-looking guy, but I'm not in the market right now for a relationship. I've got to focus on my job. I've got to focus on my kid, and I'm not looking for an involvement. So I said to him, sir, thanks for asking, but I'm really not interested. And so he laughed at me and he said, no, you misunderstand. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to pick you up. I am trying to offer you a job. She said, my ears perked up at that. And I met him for coffee the next morning. And long and the short of it is that he hired me as the front person for his real estate company. He said, I've been watching how you interact with your customers. She said, and he said to me, that's the kind of person I want representing the first contact with our company. Whether it's on the phone or walking through the door, I want you to be the first person that our customers meet. She said, I'm doing very, very well indeed. And she sort of gestured at her outfit, and I smiled and I said, my daughter recognized your outfit. Outfit is a very fine piece of clothing. And so that's what I mean by excel. Deliver more than you are asked to do. I don't know that this is true at the moment. I don't know. But when I visited Munich and I visited the factory that manufactures very fine German cars, I discovered something fascinating. And that is that German workers showed up at their places on the car assembly line 10 minutes or 15 minutes before the shift began. And they used that time to familiarize themselves with what's going on, were there any aberrations on the machine, to speak to the guy going off shift. They even did some lubrication and maintenance work on the machine so as that at the moment that their shift officially began, they were up and ready to go. They didn't show up on time. They showed up early. And I thought to myself, that's why they have job security, because they deliver to their employer just a little bit extra, and the employer parlays that into fine cars sold at a top price. So, excel, whatever it is. I spoke to somebody who is in charge of executive transport for a multinational company. And the reason I saw him is I was doing some consulting for a small department of that company. And the company arranged for me to be transported between my hotel and the company several times. And on one of those occasions, the guy who was driving me didn't look like the regular driver. And I said, you know, tell me about you. What do you do? Anyway, it turned out that a couple of years earlier, he was an Uber driver. And he said, I just made a point of jumping out to help people with baggage. I spoke to people if they wanted to be spoken to. I kept quiet if they didn't. I asked them how they wanted the air conditioning. He said, and I was cheerful always. And he said, one of my passengers on a ride offered me a job, and this was the job. So all I can tell you is, now, step one, find a job. Step two, excel at the job. Three is quite simple, spend less than you earn, all right? You must treat yourself as if you are an independent business. Don't think of yourself as an employee. Think of yourself as a business, and in a business, you have to keep financial records. So after you finish studying sales and selling by Zig Ziglar, learn to keep financial records. Learn what financial books are. Learn what a balance sheet is. Learn what a statement is. Learn what a cash flow report is. And start keeping very good financial records of your finances. And make sure that you build up a savings account. Now, I should really tell you why you should do that, but it's going to be hard for you to believe how incredibly powerful the impact is of what I'm describing. The impact is incredible. It's actually indescribable, really, because even as a beginner, and this is your first job, you got your job like I told you, you're excelling at your job, and now don't spend everything you earn, and don't go and buy a car with a car loan because now you have a job, you can qualify for credit cards and a loan. Don't do that. Start saving. And the spring this will put in your step is beyond your imagining. It goes so much beyond that. It goes so much further. There's so much that will springboard you to greater success once you have a few dollars in a savings account. It's all different. And so these are very important steps. And the fourth and final step is, during this whole process, from right now, I'm assuming I'm talking to somebody who's looking to know what to do. Like I said, somebody who says, I need to make money, but I just do not know what to do. Okay, start immediately on a fitness program. Start getting your body into tip-top shape. And whether you are a man or a woman, start on doing that. Start eating correctly. Start exercising correctly. Put yourself on a disciplined regimen. And if you do all these four things and do them well, you are on a rocket ship to the stratosphere. You really are going to do very well. Forget the idea of making a lot of money tomorrow. Yes, I know that you know a friend who from nowhere started doing this or that. He started selling on Amazon, or he started going into real estate because he had a friend who, and he's making, just forget about that. Because those sort of opportunities almost never come to people who are doing nothing. They inevitably come to people who are already on a program. And so if that lies in your future, it'll come to you even if you are already 3 months into a job. And then you're in a great position. You can decide whether to leave your job and take it up or to say, no thanks, I'm happy where I am. So there's no reason to wait until you think you know what you want to do. There's no reason to wait while you're looking for your great entrepreneurial opportunity to make a fortune. It's all of these things, if they're going to happen, they can happen anytime. But they don't happen to people who are sitting around, so do not sit around. Get on with it right away. Get with the program. Find a job. Excel at it. Save. And get fit. Those are the four steps. And of course, as I said, each one breaks down into the smaller steps. What do you have to do today to start finding a job, right? Talk to people. Decide if you can move into the sales arena, as I suggest. And I say if because some people are just so introverted that they are terrified at the thought of rejection. So then you don't do that. But whatever it is, you start talking to people, telling them you would like to a position, and speak about how your goal is to bring added value to your employer. You are really committed. Okay. And when you're interviewing, you don't ask about benefits. You don't ask how vacation policy. You're only interested in one thing, and that is how you can bring added value to your boss. That's what you're trying to do. And that's got to come across in your interview, and it's got to come across as your entire lifestyle, because that's what making money is about. The reason that making money is so dignified and noble and moral is because you are making life better for at least one other person. Now, if you're taking money instead of making money, that's different, of course. But when you're earning money, when you're making money, the only reason that another human being puts money into your hand and into your pocket and into your bank account is because you are doing something for them that is valued at more than the money they're paying you. So that's what you got to be focused on. And tell that to your friends. And tell that to your interviewer. Tell that to anybody, that that is who you are. You are a professional, devoted to the principle of adding value to your employer. That's what you are. And while these things won't initially come out of your mouth naturally, write them out, learn them by heart, so as that they do begin to flow from your mouth fluently. And these things make an impression. And that is what will move you onto the inside track. So find your job, excel at it. People will notice and puts you on the escalator. Save, right? Spend less than you earn and work on your physical fitness. And if you do all of those things, then you, within a relatively short period of time, within a year is going to go by quickly anyway, don't forget. The difference is whether in a year you're still where you are now, or whether in a year you send me an email at my website and you say, thank you, Rabbi Daniel Lappin. You said something to me in the fall of 2023, and I heard it on the podcast, and it changed my life. And that's exactly right. Follow it, and it will change your life. Happy warriors, that is as far as we're going to go today. So visit the website at rabbidaniellappin.com. If you haven't yet listened to the audio program on the book of Ruth, do yourself a favor. It's something I'm very, very proud of. I think it's a wonderful piece of work, and it is extremely helpful and extremely useful. So go ahead and get yourself at rabbidaniellappin.com. You go to online courses, and you get yourself the book of Ruth. You will thank me for that as well. You really will, as many, many, many people have. And do I sound boastful about that? I'm proud of it. I am proud that I am serving other human beings. I am proud that I bring added value to each one of you happy warriors. And if you enjoy the book of Ruth, then I will have brought added value to you. And I'm pretty sure that you will, and that I will have done so. So please go ahead and move forwards with your finances, your family, your faith, your friendships, and your fitness, onwards and upwards with all of that, until we are together again next week on the Rabbi Daniel Lappin Show. God bless.
Stream and subscribe to more Blaze Media content at theblaze.com/podcasts.